This is the Bike Snob of New York City, and you're listening to The Bike Show on Resonance FM 104.4.
London is the place for me. London, this lovely city. You can go to France or America, India, Asia, or Australia, but you must come back to London City. Well, believe me, I am speaking broad-mindedly. I am glad to know my mother country. I've been traveling to countries years ago, but this the place I wanted to know.
London, that's the place for me.
Welcome to The Bike Show here on Resonance FM. My name's Jack Thurston, and it looks as if the long, cold winter may be behind us. A beautiful, sunny weekend. But a much longer, colder winter has been the winter that has afflicted cycling in London, probably back to sometime in the mid-1960s. London has been a pretty grim place to ride a bike, even though we all manage it. It's not the greatest place in the world to ride a bike. But it seems as though there may be a change afoot. The newly elected mayor, Boris Johnson, who famously rides a bike himself, has published a new vision for cycling in London. And to help me look at this big subject, I have an expert panel, a round table, if you like, in the studio here at Resonance FM. I have familiar bike show contributor, Buffalo Bill Chidley, prolific blogger and former London bike messenger. I have Trevor Parsons, who's the coordinator of Hackney Cyclists, the Hackney chapter of the London Cycling Campaign. And I have Mark Treasure, who's one of the new generation of bloggers who are making a real impact on cycling policy. His blog is called As Easy As Riding a Bike. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Bike Show.
Thanks for having us.
Perhaps before we get into the actual concrete elements of the plan, let's talk a little bit about the context, the political context of this new announcement. Mark Treasure, let me come to you first. How did cycling figure in the mayoral election?
Largely, I think, due to some great work by London Cycling Campaign. I think that they really pushed it high on the agenda. They made it visible with the Go Dutch big ride, and they kind of made it impossible for Boris and the other candidates to ignore.
It was also a national newspaper coming in, I think, well, probably had a big impact. The Times ran their Cycle Safe campaign after one of their reporters. She's still in a terrible critical coma condition, isn't she? More than a year after she was knocked off her bike. Boris, I think, saw cycling as something that he had claimed as a political issue, partly because riding a bike kind of goes with his image of himself, but also he's not been a particularly activist mayor. He's not got a lot to show for his first term. He's got a load of blue bicycles and some blue paint on the streets, and that was his biggest physically visible legacy, wasn't it, Trevor?
I think you're right, yes. His opponents have always said that, he's been, his first term, he's been, cutting the ribbon on a lot of things that were planned, you know, before he came in. And that's obviously true to some extent. Also, in the case of the bike share scheme, which I like to call them either the people's bikes or even the LCC bikes, because we got all of the candidates to sign up to deliver those. But obviously plaudits to Boris for actually delivering them. That, as a symbol, probably even more than the superhighways, has kind of brought cycling right in front of everyone's face and made it something that there's a very small transition between being a man in the street, a woman in the street, and a quote-unquote cyclist.
Basically, we had a go at him for doing very little and actually making it less safe to cycle in London. Because, I mean, that's sort of the net effect of Boris's policies. He's sort of relaxed the speed limit. Average speeds have gone up. Accident rates have gone up, depending on who you believe. I mean, Jenny Jones, who probably knows more about it than Boris does, says that it's got less safe. So we're all having a go at Boris at the time of the last election for having done very little new. As Trevor was saying, he did cut the ribbon on a lot of schemes. But I mean, what has he done really?
Well, the cycle superhighways, the road user hierarchy, which put pedestrians and cyclists. That was something that Boris and the GLA Conservatives got rid of. They tried to pretend all road users are equal, and obviously the smoothing traffic flow policy, both of those policies quite detrimental to cycling in London. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to those two policies with this new cycling vision.
He was counting on getting the cyclists' vote, and we basically bit him in the bum.
He did seem a bit shocked.
I mean, there was that meeting, wasn't there? The Times hustings, where it was quite an ill-tempered atmosphere.
Rightly so. I mean, he's not entitled to our vote just because he rides a bike. That's absurd.
I mean, I don't know how everyone who gets on a bike votes. You know, I mean, we're the chattering classes of the people who ride bikes. You know, there are plenty of other people who ride bikes, and I have no idea how they vote. You know, there are a lot of people who ride up and down to the city and work in banks. I mean, they may be politically conservative.
You could say that might have been one of the big influential factors. A lot more people riding bikes into the city, more influential politically, more likely to hurt Boris politically, potentially.
But still, his vote is mainly, surely, kept up by Outer London.
Well, that's what the electoral maps show, isn't it? That you've got this... You've got this Boris vote in the donut, and then actually where the cycling's happening is in central London. But so how do you think we got from that ill-tempered meeting a couple of days before the election to this Vision for Cycling in London document, which I think has been hailed by everybody who's looked at it as something quite new and quite a big step change? And what I'm struck by, as well as the Crossrail for the bicycle, which had a very impressive visualisation of amazing Dutch-style cycle lanes all the way along the embankment of the Thames, is how he's trying to make cycling an everyday activity that's something anyone can do. And he talks about cycling in ordinary clothes, wanting more women cycling, more older people cycling, more black and minority ethnic Londoners cycling, the kind of cyclists you see in Holland going at a leisurely pace on often clunky steeds. Mark, that must be music to your ears, because you're part of the Cycling Embassy of Great Britain, which has it as its logo a Dutch bicycle, and very much argues for this kind of Dutch approach to cycling. It's something for everyone.
Yes, obviously it's quite remarkable to read those kind of words from Boris, given that only maybe a year and a half ago he was telling people to keep your wits about you, and Elephant Castle is fine for anyone, as long as you just keep your eyes open. So it's the language has changed massively. Obviously the delivery is another issue, but it was incredibly refreshing.
The whole document is written in a very astute way, and I think you've got the touch of Gilligan there, doing a very good job in ticking the boxes for everyone who's going to read it, and that includes all the supposed divisions and fine-grained differences within the cycling movement as well.
So let's talk about Andrew Gilligan. He's the Mayor's Cycling Commissioner. He's a prominent journalist, became extremely prominent over the BBC's coverage of the Iraq War dossier and the fallout from Dr. David Kelly's death. That's a whole other story which I don't want to go into on the bike show, but he's a celebrity journalist, right, who happens to ride a bike and is been a prominent supporter of Boris and hounder of Ken Livingstone in his pieces for the Evening Standard. So he's been appointed to this job 2 days a week, I think
that's right.
I understand. And so does that suggest that it's a bit more of a serious appointment than 2 days a week for Colby Arranger, for all his charms, a much more lowly political figure than Andrew Gilligan?
I don't think Colby got it. I don't think he was particularly hot on bikes from what I saw of him. Whereas Gilligan does seem to get the issues. He seems more informed. Again, whether this is going to translate into anything, I don't know. But from when I went to see him at the London Cycling Policy Forum, he seems to have the right answers. He was informed. He didn't just people didn't seem clueless.
So he's been listening and not just basing it all on his own personal experience of cycling from Greenwich to Fleet Street every day.
I mean, I don't know. I found his appointment kind of insulting. I was sort of insulted by it, that the idea that someone who's been riding a bike for 6 years somehow has, you know, is qualified in any way to do this job, which is actually really important. I mean, the transport is the one thing that the mayor really is in charge of. He's in charge of very little else. And this is one of his flagship policies, and he's appointed a journalist to what is... You need someone who's got more technical qualifications, I think.
But really? Because don't they have lots of people with technical qualifications in Transport for London and in the groups that get consulted? And what you need is a salesman.
Possibly. I mean, maybe I'm being a bit unfair, and what Mark's saying possibly gives the lie to what I'm saying. And also, if you look at what happened at the Standard, because I think he was the reason why the Standard signed, because we did a special podcast.
We sat on a lovely day in the sunshine. We were sitting in my back garden in Waterloo, and we were talking about the Standard having come out for cycling in London and how this was a remarkable day. Was that 2007?
2008. Yeah, Knowsley Rag suddenly becomes cycling friendly in it. So if Gilligan achieves that kind of change, if it's not just cosmetic...
There's a big number that got the headlines, isn't there, which was a billion. And Mark, how does that number break down?
Well, it's not actually a billion, of course. It's 9/10 of a billion. And also, a significant portion of this is reliant on central government, and there's a lot of questions about whether it's actually going to arrive. Boris obviously probably won't be around 4 years' time. And yes, and it's still quite a long way short of Dutch levels of spending.
Bob Davis from the Road Data Reduction Forum had it at 90 million per year.
That's over 10 years, I think.
Okay.
It's front-loaded a bit, I think.
Right, and he said that 150 million would be more proportionate to the mode share.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are they going to be spending this questionable sum of money on?
We don't really know as yet, because there are these mini Hollands, there are these boroughs, outer London boroughs, that are it's either between one and three, or maybe even four boroughs that will be putting forward bids to get some of this money, 100 million. Whether that's all going to be spent or not, I don't know, because obviously some outer London boroughs don't really like cycling at all.
And so, well, assuming that some that do like cycling come forward, what are they going to be encouraged to do with that money?
I think boroughs like Brent, it's going to be issues of severance, getting across these big junctions, big railways. There are lots of... That's where their money will have to be spent, I think.
So lots of bridges over the North Circular.
Yeah, or just reallocating space, redesigning these gyratories and getting safe routes across them, because there's a huge issue of severance in Brent that I know of. So,
and is that enough to create a cycling outer London borough, having a few bridges over railway lines and main roads?
No, that's going to be the issue, I think.
What else is on the menu? A tube network for the bike, I'm reading from the... from the document here. London will have a network of direct high-capacity joined-up cycle routes. Many will run in parallel with key underground rail and bus routes, radial and orbital, signed and branded accordingly, the Bakerloo Superhighway, the Circle Quiet Way, and so on. There'll be a bike crossrail, which is going to go from sort of Brentford to Canary Wharf, including, as Bill said, a terrifying section of the West Way.
That's kind of going back into a bit of cycling history as well, because the first bike lane famously was along Western Avenue, which is part of West Way. But yeah, I find who the hell is going to... I mean, he talks about permeability, and then he talks about permeability in other points in the document, and then he comes up with this bike lane which he won't be able to get off for about a mile.
Yeah,
I mean, it just seems crazy.
Yeah, that section of it is going to be a commuter route. The devil's going to be in the detail. It seems a bit crazy to put a route up in the sky, but I think it's more of a symbolic thing. Yeah. Again, this big thing.
How much is it going to cost? It's going to have to be some serious engineering to make it safe. They're going to have to put. They're going to have to put a concrete barrier up there.
Well, he's saying it's going to be the largest, predominantly segregated cycle route in the world or in Europe.
There are some serious issues that will have to be tackled along the route, because this embankment one, it's going to have to either go through Parliament Square. Huh. It's going to have ultra. There's going to be some serious issues. I think if it happens, it's great, but it's easy to put these lanes in and visualise them on the embankment.
Yeah.
But it's going to have to get through Parliament Square. That's going to have to involve signal timings, taking space away from the car, and that's going to be where it's going to be.
I mean, do you think that there's a willingness to take space away from the car from what you've heard from Andrew Gilligan?
It's happening already this year. You know, Stratford High Street, it's going down from three lanes to two. I think possibly the autumn that's going to arrive, which is a huge amount of space taken away from the car. So that's happening already. And Superhighway 5, I think, whether that's being tweaked again, there's reallocation of space through the gyratory, Foxhill gyratory there as well. So it's happening. Whether it's going to go much further or not.
It seems as though the TfL group think on this is that these commuter routes are the essential infrastructure intervention that needs to be made in London, that cycling in London is a matter of rushing into the centre in the morning and rushing back out again every day, and you just have to provide overground bicycle-operated tube lines so that you can get people off the tubes and solve the overcrowding problem on the tubes. Mm. Whereas another vision, which I'd like Trevor to elaborate on a little bit, is about public realm, about making places and spaces more friendly to people.
The headline figure that drew some attention to Hackney recently was the 2011 census results, which showed...
Well, excellent.
Well, they're pretty good, yeah. This is the commuters. This is the number of... proportion or whatever overall numbers of people who cycle to work, and yes, now that's tripled to 17,300 or whatever. We even thought it was pretty good in 2001 compared to 1991. That's brilliant because it's the commuting. That's the way people earn their living at the moment. You know, that is the basis still of cycling in Hackney. But there is actually also a lot of other type, you know, purposes for which people are riding bikes.
But how has Hackney achieved that? Or how has that happened in Hackney? Maybe there's nobody actually doing something that to achieve something. It just has happened.
Well, there has been a lot of work done, I would say. And, you know, obviously the council, ourselves, as a sort of concerted local group of London Cycling Campaign, but also a lot of kind of grassroots work as well. 1997, I remember sitting in a cycle liaison meeting with Hackney Council with about three people, including the road safety officer, and going, we think cycle training might be good, teaching people who don't ride at the moment how to ride bikes and stuff. That might be quite good, whether adults or children. And the road safety officer going, well, I've tried, you know, I put notices up in schools and I don't get much take up, you know. And really that only took off. Now we have, I think, if it's not the largest, one of the largest continuous, you know, annual training programs. And that's actually started from a germ of some parents in Sir Thomas Abney Primary School in Stoke Newington. London Cycling Campaign, we gave them £200 to start the first training, and it grew up into a programme which is now, you know, £250,000 a year, and, you know, it sees at least half the kids in Hackney Primary Schools being, I think it may be more actually, being having good quality training.
But does that mean they actually cycle to school?
Well, that's another question. That is another question. That you've got to concentrate on the parents as well, and the family unit, and obviously the infrastructure outside and the conditions. On the conditions, I would say we've been working very closely with the engineers for, I would say, 15 years or so, turning them round. They were fairly conventional, engineering professionals in a local authority, dealing with the same infrastructural issues as every other inner London, which is, you know, saturation of car parking, growing car use levels, loads of one-way systems, large and small, junctions which were engineered for fast movement through there. Out of courtesy, they show us things. We get an early glance at stuff, and we look at what they're doing to a junction, or to just a very small adjustment of where a bus stop is, or a crossing, or something like that. And everything is now done to reduce the capacity of motor vehicles as much as possible and slow down their movement through junctions. And junctions is where crashes happen.
Dutch is a word that appears a number of times in the document. Do you think that they've really understood the way they do things in Holland?
In principle, yes. It's all about inclusivity. The language is about inclusivity and allowing children to cycle unaccompanied. And obviously they've got the issue of the main roads having to be suitable and also having good routes on these quiet ways, which are direct. Because the problem we've had over the last 20 or 30 years is the quiet routes have been the ones that wiggle around the houses. They're on back streets. They're not direct, so no one uses them. It seems to be that the quiet ways concept, it does emphasise directness, which I think is very important.
I heard Andrew Keeligan say that essentially the quiet ways is the LCN done right.
Properly, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of big issue with it was that a lot of these streets, these quiet streets, were still used. So you'd be going like motor traffic, quite a lot of motor traffic. You'd be going along the streets, and it's got parking on both sides, and someone's coming towards you, and you have to give way. And
filtering exactly. will certainly help
a
lot.
Exactly.
We want a lot more filtering in Hackney,
because that cuts out that rat running and the.
I mean, this is the Hackney's, I guess, signature policy, isn't it, of some bollards. You know, basically blocking off one road with
politically
a bollard.
Could be politically expensive. But it doesn't, you know, it's happened. We've done it in Goldsmith Row, for instance. That's lots of people have seen that.
Just this week, we've seen Chester Avenue, Earlham Street, filter permeability at one end. I think Warren Street's been done. Yeah. So it's spreading.
Yeah,
And it does have an amazing effect on what it's like to be on those streets, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I'm very, very glad to say that the vision mentions this specifically. And that gives political cover, really. Of course, you're still down to a ward level, councillors worrying about their, you know, will I get re-elected in 2014 if I say I'm going to take a car parking off one side of a street in order to allow two-way cycling and that sort of stuff, or put in filter permeability and so someone will have a longer journey if they want to take their kids to school by car.
It improves the environment of the street where the residents live, so... Hypothetically, it's quite an easy sell.
I mean, there were some amazing pictures put out by Sustrans in Wales the other day that got quite good press coverage. They're available on the web, and they show photographs from maybe 40 or 50 years ago of kids playing in the streets. And then they show a photograph of that street now, just stuffed with cars parked, cars coming along too fast. And no kids, obviously, no kids playing in the street. And it just shows how streets... were once places, and now they are
storage facilities.
They're storage facilities for cars. And on the subject of parking, I want to play a quick bit of tape when I spoke some years ago now to Klaus Bondam, who was in charge of cycling as a mayor of Copenhagen, and I asked him what was the most important thing that you could do to make cities and towns better for cycling.
The toughest decision is when you have to reduce parking places to make a bicycle lane. I usually describe it sort of as the cultural value battle of the cities. The car, the individual car, has for many people sort of is the symbol of personal freedom and individual freedom. And of course, for all of us who live in democratic societies, when we feel that somebody touches our individual freedom, I mean, we feel insecure, we get pressed, and that creates some quite big confrontation sometimes politically.
Car parking is the third rail of getting a cycling-friendly city, isn't it? Because you do have to remove car parking to make space for bike lanes.
Well, I would say you need to support continued rollout of controlled parking zones, or residence parking zones as they're known. In our borough, that hasn't even been completed, again, because it is pretty much, you know, trench warfare and attrition.
How does that help, though? Because it's still been got cars.
No, because you get rid of a load of cars. You get rid of tons of cars if you put in a controlled parking zone.
And where do they go?
Well, they go back to Essex, or they go to the scrapyard.
So this is people who are driving in.
They're driving in and then getting on the train.
And they're using free parking.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, people, I can't imagine we're still dealing with this in 2013, that someone can drive in from, I don't know, Harlow, park up somewhere next to Victoria Park, and wander down and get on the tube.
But those people from Harlow, they don't vote in Hackney elections.
No.
So how come their say has any importance
at all?
Well,
their say doesn't have any.
But the people that they're competing with who do live there.
Parking zones are really unpopular. I mean, any parking control, as your man said on the clip, you know, it's all about personal freedom. And we were talking about, before we came in, about the cultural change that happened in the sort of early 90s where more cars started to be seen as a bad thing. The thing that needs to happen culturally is for less cars to be seen as a good thing, and we're not quite there yet.
It's tricky because I think people are so viscerally attached to their cars because, rightly or wrongly, they don't see that they have an alternative for getting their kids to school. Or so, although it's an issue, it has to be tackled sensitively. And I think Gilligan is tiptoeing around it slightly because he doesn't want to go in head first and tackle parking, because I think it's going to get people's backs up straight away, and it might prove difficult.
But you get the sense that yeah. he knows that it needs to be done.
It's an issue, yes, certainly. I'm not so convinced it's such an issue on residential streets, because if you are doing things like Hackney, doing the filtered permeability, it's not too much of an issue having parking on both sides of the street, because the street is quiet. It only becomes an issue when you've still got it being used as a through route. But obviously, the parking on main roads is going to be an issue. We've got this ludicrous situation where you have parking in superhighways. I've suckered along Victoria Street to get here this morning from Victoria Station, right past where the lady was killed this week, and there's parking on that street, which is ridiculous. You know,
on top of the blue paint.
There's no blue paint on Victoria Street, but it's, you know, it's a four-lane road, but it's just parking. Because Sunday, people
well,
just
you,
park
and
on
you
it.
Can park on a Sunday on Waterloo Bridge.
Yeah. So just
both sides.
Yeah, which that has to stop. It's the main roads, I think, is the most pressing issue. I think a lot of it is business related. Businesses still see their customers arriving by car, even though people who don't arrive by car spend more. That they see the car as, that's our customer. So the idea, I think it's going to be businesses on these main roads that are going to be the big issue, getting rid of parking spaces.
Yeah, I mean, I think loading is obviously, you need it. In quite a lot of places, I think a brick lane, it's not really a main road, but it's a really important artery for avoiding main roads, actually, if you like, by bike. And currently you can't go... Which way is it? Southbound?
Yeah.
Because...
You're not supposed to, yeah.
Because it's parked... the business owners there insist on having parking. And it really is just parking for them to drive to their work. You know, and there's plenty of... But in the back streets. Of course, there is the other point on main streets that has been observed, that you can end up... If you take parking off main streets and put it on the side streets, you can end up with more collisions because your cross movements, turning movements, you know, and that, which is where a lot of collisions occur, and that happens whether you have a protected lane or not, you know.
Yeah,
I want to bring things to a conclusion by asking each of you to say what you think would be a marker of the success of this vision, that if in a few years' time this thing has happened, and so something fairly concrete, fairly achievable within the realms of possibility, that if this has happened, then this vision and this change is for real. Bill, I'm going to start with you.
I'm not really sure. I think it would be something not very tangible, like my sister-in-law letting her kids cycle to school. You know, if that happens, then cycling would have changed. Because that's the thing that we're all kind of fencing around. But basically, you want kids cycling.
Tourists cycling through Parliament Square, taking pictures, taking pictures of Big Ben, maybe.
As they're riding along.
Yeah.
If I was going to go really local, it would be the Kingsland Road becoming a nicer place to be. Because, I mean, it's horrible to walk down at the moment.
Mm-hmm. The good thing about this is it looks as if there's a large amount of flexibility on the funding. So, yeah. Something like that, an outcome like that. If this funding can go towards public realm as well as, you know, very specific stuff, then that's good.
Well, you can read Mark Treasure on As Easy As Riding a Bike, the blog, and Bill is everywhere, but particularly on Buffalo Bill's bike blog. And of course, you can join the London Cycling Campaign if you live in Hackney and be a member of Hackney Cyclists, Trevor will be your man.
Or someone could come take over if they like.
Do you accept honorary members from across other borders?
Anyone's welcome. We meet on the first Wednesday of the month in just close to Hackney Central stations. Look us up at hackney.cc.
OK, well, let's reconvene in about 2016 and see how far we've got with all this. Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Bike Show on Resonance FM. From me, Jack Thurston. Goodbye.